So I had a horrifying conversation with my mother this week. Comedically horrifying. So I was talking to her about a dinner party that my parents had had a week or two ago. And she was going on about what she had served and so on. And this little phrase popped out at me. She said, "And so your sermon was just about finished when we reached dessert. So then I served the chocolate mousse." I said, "Well, wait a minute. What do you mean my sermon was just about finished?" She said, "Well, you know how you have those sermons. The church puts your sermons online. So we were listening to your sermons during the dinner party." And I said, "Wait a minute, Mom. You subjected your dinner party guests to my sermon." "Oh, no, no. They liked it so much, we listened to two." So then my dad got on the phone and he said, "You know, you haven't told that one story about the blizzard, and you got to tell that story." And I said, "You know, Dad, it's a very complicated process of why and how, the creative spirit moves me to tell a story and so on. And I'm sure maybe at some point in the future that blizzard story would be appropriate, but, you know, it doesn't work that way." And then I hung up with them and I thought, "Yeah, you know, that blizzard story is actually really good for this Sunday." So I guess parents know best, right, up at the end, right? So tell the blizzard story then. So I was pretty young, I think probably seven, 8 years old, something like that. And again, you know, we lived in Indiana, and we had a blizzard one year. And it snowed all night, and there was a good 3 feet of snow outside everywhere. School was canceled. You couldn't get anywhere. Nobody went to work. The roads were impassable. There weren't enough snow plows to clear the roads. And so we were stuck in our house. Now, my brother, who was 6 years older than me, had been spending the night before at his friend's house. And so he was at the top of a hill that we lived at the bottom of. And we heard, he called and told us that they were busy trying to shovel the driveway so that family could get out and get to the main road. And my parents thought, well, wouldn't it be nice if we sent Matt, my brother, a little care package, and we'll have Jason take it to him up the hill. And so they made a little lunchbox with cookies in it and a thermos full of hot cocoa and so on. And I was thrilled to have this responsibility that I was going to trudge up the hill in this blizzard, the snowstorm, and deliver the cookies and hot chocolate to my brother, who I pictured would be very, very grateful, though he never had been grateful about anything I'd done before. So I don't know why I thought that would change, but I did. So anyway, I set off with the little lunchbox with the thermos and the cookies and so on, and started to climb that hill. Well, let me tell you, that snow was deep. It was up to my waist easily, and each step was an effort. And eventually, and didn't take very long, and for those of you from the Midwest or back east, you know that feeling when the cold water starts to finally seep into your boots and around your legs and feet. So I started to feel that, and I knew, even with my perception at 7 years old, that this is probably about over. Meanwhile, I was only about a third of the way up the hill. So I did what I thought was absolutely natural in that process. Before I turned around and headed home, I sat down in the snow, opened the lunchbox, had the cookies, and drank the hot chocolate. And let me tell you, it was delicious. Nothing has ever tasted so good. And in my defense, I'll say at that point, the hot chocolate was only lukewarm, so it never would have, made it all the way up the hill anyway. So I got home, and the story goes that, I was busy formulating in my head the whole narrative I was going to have to explain to them, that I tried to get up the hill and it was too much and so on. Well, they opened the front door, and of course there's this little kid with a ring of chocolate around his mouth. And the story was obvious to them. I didn't need to explain it at all. So the moral of this story is that even with our best intentions, sometimes we have to stop and take care of ourselves. So the blizzard, that image that my parents gifted me with this week, I think that blizzard is here for us that chaotic, shocking, cold whirl that threatens to swallow us up. Neo-Nazis, ISIS, North Korea. Pardon of Joe Arpaio, Donald Trump. The blizzard rages, and we are knee-deep in it. And so our first instinct might be to want to do something, to do everything even, to set out in the snow even though it's waist high and save the day, to consume every news story we can to try and make sense of the world, to attend every march and rally to show our resistance. Or perhaps our reaction is the opposite. It's to run away, to just bury our head in the snow, never mind the cold, and try and wait it out. So my question today is, in the meantime, whatever we choose to do, what happens to our souls? Okay, I know we're Unitarian Universalists. I can never get away with just saying a word like soul and thinking we're all on the same page with it. So let's talk about that for just a minute. Traditional religious language usually centers around the idea that soul is mainly important because of its relationship to the theological concept of life after death. We Unitarian Universalists, however, have no one way of understanding life after death. But nonetheless, I argue that the concept of the soul can still be important to us. So what is the soul? What is it exactly? I like to think of it as a way of describing that ineffable something lived out in each and every one of us, the resulting electricity that comes out of the individual worth and dignity that our first principle talks about. Our soul is to be found in the uniqueness that we each bring to our connected lives, to the larger community around us, and even to the world itself. I'm talking about the soul not as something beyond this world, but very much a part of it, a descriptor of our essential humanness. Inspired by Jungian psychology, mythology, and the arts, theologian and psychotherapist Thomas More says, "Soul is not a thing, but a quality or dimension of experiencing life and ourselves. It has to do with depth, value, relatedness, heart, and personal substance." I do not use the word here as an object of religious belief or as something to do with immortality. In other words, soul is a way of being or even doing, as opposed to simply an object unto itself. Take African-American author and entertainer Sheila Ferguson's conception of soul food. "Ah, soul food," she says. "Soul is just what the name implies. It is soulfully cooked or richly flavored foods good for your ever-loving soul. It is a legacy clearly steeped in tradition from one black family to another, by word of mouth and sleight of hand. It is rich in both history and a variety of flavor." Isn't that what each one of us is? Rich in both history and a variety of flavor. And the second part of soul in this context is learning to savor that history, that variety, to experience it for all its worth, just as Ferguson might savor soul food staples like collard greens or black-eyed peas. It is in this quality of being, of doing, of living out our lives that we reach for the word soul, a word that gestures beyond science and rationality and toward the abstract and poetic. Unitarian Universalist minister Wayne Arneson says, "We don't have a word in the English language that comes any closer to describing this meeting place, this crossroads, where our separated, embodied lives encounter so much at once. The world around us, the unconscious archetypes which surround us, the history that we pull behind us and the aspirations and values that we envision in front of us. And even if we are ultimately primarily machines, biological ones, influenced by a whole host of factors, I would suggest that the unique individual that is created is so perfectly imperfect in its difference from others that there is in that space a perfect imperfection, this engine we call the soul, we can call the soul if we choose to do so. This engine within each of us that is the spark that makes us who we are. The engine we see in another's eyes when we look deeply. That engine that we fall in love with in someone else. That engine that has a great power for compassion and creativity and healing. Our souls can soar to great heights of imagination, can inspire us to love so deeply our bones ache, and they can help us to pick up the pieces and go forward after a great loss. And yes, this soul engine can be battered and bruised and even broken. It can be frozen out in the midst of a great blizzard. Which is why part of the work here in this church community is to learn to care for our souls, as corny as I know that may sound to some of you. Thomas More says, care of the soul begins with observance of how the soul manifests itself and how it operates. We can't care for the soul unless we are familiar with its ways. Observance is a word from ritual and religion. It means to watch out for, but also to honor and keep, as in the observance of a holiday. Observe and observance, originally referred to tending sheep. Observing the soul, we keep an eye on its sheep, on wherever they're wandering to, wherever they're grazing. The question then is, are we taking the time to observe our souls? Are we trudging blindly through the snow, intent on delivering whatever we may carry, and forgetting to stop and nourish ourselves along the way? In the midst of the blizzard of daily bad news from Charlottesville, Virginia, to the White House, to countless other examples of the brokenness and poverty of mind, body, and spirit that surrounds us, do we stop and take time to consider the nourishment of that inner spark of ourselves, our souls? I mean, if ever there were a time to sit down and go ahead and eat the cookies and hot cocoa, it's now, right? I think logic and rationality are only taking us so far. I think we're in a time where we have to create a soul response. I mean, we know that, right? The arguments around rationality and facts, they're not having the effect we would like them to have. We have to find a way that is different, a way through our spiritual practices. And I'm talking about things from meditation to arts to exercise to whatever it is that personally sustains you and keeps you going on a fundamental level. And a spiritual practice is also supposed to open you up to let whatever may come. And I think the answers for how we continue to go forward comes out of this space of uncertainty, of opening ourselves up. In his book, Soul Making, Alan Jones says, soul making has something to do with paying attention to the things invisible, things which do not lend themselves to manipulation and control. Soul making requires a move away from the need and desire to control, to a waiting on the mystery at the heart of things. It means cultivating a readiness for wonder and being ready for the special kind of pain that contemplative availability to reality always brings. In other words, soul nourishing, soul making will not be without growing pains. So ultimately, I don't think it matters very much if we understand spiritual practices as self-created through our own intellects and imaginations, or whether we understand them as conduits of God or divine spirit. For the point of spiritual practices is not the theory behind them, but the time that we take to open ourselves up to the signposts, scenery, obstacles, and companions of our inner selves. That's how we care for our souls. I wish I had all the answers of whether we have souls that will survive in one way or another after we die. I have my own feelings, but I don't have answers for all of you. I'm familiar with all the various philosophical and religious understandings of soul. Aristotle, with his intertwined relationship of the soul and body as a life force. Buddhism, which sees the ever-changing nature of life, and thus a soul is not a fixed thing. Christianity, seeing souls as essential parts of human beings that will have eternal life. Hinduism, which sees the soul as a direct connection to God. Judaism, which sees souls as given to humans by God. Our own Unitarian Ralph Waldo Emerson, with his concept of the oversoul. Leave it to the Unitarians. We couldn't leave it at soul. We've got the oversoul we have to talk about, which can be described as the absolute reality and basis of all existences, conceived as a spiritual being in which the ideal nature imperfectly manifested in human beings is perfectly realized. So that's a whole other sermon. I'm not even going to break that down today. But the point is, we've been wrestling with this concept of the soul, all these different religions, our own faith traditions included, philosophers, theologians, scholars, since time began, what it means to be human and what it doesn't mean to be human. And the common theme among them is that we humans are always looking to understand ourselves in terms beyond the everyday basic concerns of just food and shelter. Even the question of the soul itself, one surfacing again and again throughout history and here in this room today, shows our desire, our yearning to understand ourselves as something more. But that something doesn't have to be anything beyond this world. I mean, we have enough to occupy us here. As Alan Jones says, we become more and more who we are. Another way of talking about soul making, who we are, when we struggle with the four last things, the things invisible, as he calls them, love, death, power, and time. To be a soul, to be fully nature and alive as a person, is to struggle in hope with love, because we know that at our deepest, we are loved. That's right out of our universalist tradition. To be a soul is to know what it is to be a terminal case, to have come to terms, however minimally, with the fact that we are going to die. To be a soul means to know what it is to struggle for, to achieve, and to be denied power. To be a soul is to live in time, with all its opportunities and limitations. Our life is a story that slowly unfolds in time. And let us remember that as each of our souls' individual stories unfold in time, so too do they touch one another's stories, just like they are here in this room today. And in so doing, our souls are shaped by one another. May we take time amidst the raging blizzards to care for one another, be gentle with one another, and hold one another, accountable as we do the soul work that leads us toward the best of what we can be. The blizzard rages, but our souls are steady.